All right, starting part two of the lecture. Looking at the capacity to see and where it comes from, that it's not a material thing, that the capacity to see is in the being of the animal, which is a sensitivity to light. That in a sense, I would say, if we're just being scientifically factual, it inherits. Yes, that the capacity to see. Again, I have a little kind of a mythical story for the evolution of life, and somewhere the sensitivity to photonic energy emerged in living systems, first on the skin, you know, and then eyes formed with lenses that could actually focus some kind of form from in a distance onto another piece of sensitive skin. But within that, a capacity arose to have an experience of what that means. Maybe that's not a right way to say it in Heideggerian terms. But remember, he's talking about the capacity's there whether you destroy the eye or not. Yes, it's in the being of the animal to see, whereas it's not clear that that's in the being of a plant. A plant has other kinds of sensitivity, but not a sensitivity to see, which is a sensitivity to, in some sense, the information that's contained in light, which is the information of what's occurring at a distance. It's a traversal of space. The capacity to see is connected to sensing at a distance, which is in some sense necessary for a form of life that can move. Yes? In order to, it goes together, the capacity to see and capacity to move. Although there's a sense in which plants move in relation to the sun, they've chosen, if we can use that word, to root themselves. So the sense that Heidegger's trying to give here is that the capacity to see is present in some sense in the physical manifestation of eyes, and it's there in advance. And it's diverting itself into its own wherefore. Its own wherefore, in some sense, is, as Heidegger's going to say, the environment that it sees. But we've got to get into what the environment is for the animal. This is when Heidegger starts to say something new, I think. This sense of the distinction between the environment and the world. So the capacity, he's saying that this capacity to see governs the morphogenic process of the growth of the body, and the emergence of eyes. But not in any physicalistic sense. You know, there's no energetic sense in it. It's almost two sides of the same coin. The capacity to see and having eyes obviously go together, but he's giving an account of the being of an organism that can see. The life of the organism produces the eyes. Does it see because it can produce eyes, or does it produce eyes because it can see? In a way, he's saying, well, it's the capacity that comes first. I guess my view of it is that it's circular in a way, that something you could almost follow Darwin and say, as a matter of some accident, some surface of the animal became sensitive to photonic energy, and that happened, and then there was a response in the being of the animal that reception of photonic light was mirrored in an experience. But then the capacity to see gets passed on in the reproduction. But I have a sort of a Rupert Sheldrake-y kind of idea that there are something like morphogenic fields that hold these capacities that we didn't. I often think about this, like colour, like we experience a certain quality to the colour red. Now we didn't, as children say, kind of try and work out how to have an experience of red. Now, we had to work out how to see the world through experience, but the quality of red, the quality of what it is to see, was already there. We just had to, if you like, attune the apparatus, and we might look into exactly how that attuning happens. But the capacity to see, the capacity to experience colour, we're born with it. And we just need the right organs, and we see colours. It's not that because the organ grew that we experience colours. The organs can't. Do you see? The organs can't create the colours. The pure quality of the colours. So where do they come from? And it's like a dot dot dot. It's just a rhetorical question. Where does the quality, the quality you experience when you see red here? It didn't evolve. Now the ability to pick up photons evolved, but the fact that photonic energy of a certain wavelength hitting the back of the retina and going in the eye produces the experience of redness. The redness didn't evolve. The redness is coming, if you like, a kind of pure creation. You know, all the qualities of the senses, it's remarkable. One almost knows that as an animal evolves with a higher degree of ability to distinguish sensorily something in the environment, like bird's eyes can distinguish more colours than we can, there'll be a different spectrum of quality associated with that. But you could say the capacity to distinguish in the eye evolved, but the qualities didn't evolve. As soon as the eye is there that can distinguish more than our eye, there will be more colour. There'll be new colours. And where do they come from? Do you see there's no mechanistic account that you can give as to where the colours come from? The mechanistic account can only give an account of the physical ability to distinguish. You know, we've got our rods and our cones, and they're sensitive to light in a certain way that determines in advance how many colours we can distinguish. But that doesn't determine the quality of the colours. That's all part of the capacity to see has all of the colours in it already. It's amazing. I don't know if that quite answers your question, Maria.
I just wondered what the wherefore was, really.
Yeah, its own wherefore. In a way, he wants to say that the capacity knows in advance the wherefore of where it's going. Now,
the being of the finished product readiness knows. Oh, I see. The being of a product.
It's the capacity diverts itself in its own wherefore. It knows what seeing is in advance.
Right.
It has the colours at its disposal.
Whereas the hammer doesn't know.
It doesn't have any wherefore in itself, right? The hammer gets its wherefore from us.
Yeah.
Okay. He's just using wherefore to be an absolutely general sense of what seeing is aiming at. It's already encapsulated in the being, this capacity to see. And not just, you know, it knows what seeing is in a way. And then, a ready-made piece of equipment has a prescription which we make about its possible use. It gets its possible use from us. It's determined by the production. Whereas something that is capable is intrinsically regulative and regulates itself. I mean, I'm almost tempted to say the self-regulation is a... This is why I'm going to think we're going to have to talk about cybernetics, because machines regulate themselves. The classic example is the Watt governor. I don't know if you know about the Watt governor. It was a very early thing that was added to a steam engine. That if you had a steam engine and it you put a load on it, if it's driving something and you put a load on it, then it slows down, yes, and it'll stop unless there's somebody there controlling the flow of the steam to the engine. You see, in the initial steam engine, if you put a load on it, then somebody had to be operating it like a car. Like going up a hill, you have to put the throttle down. And the Watt governor recognised that if the machine started slowing down, the Watt governor was engineered in such a way that it would cause more steam to enter into the engine and cause it to speed up. And as it sped up, the Watt governor automatically said, "Oh, you're speeding up. I'll restrict the amount of steam." So it just balanced whatever load you put on the machine. It would carry on at the same speed. And Heidegger should have known about this, because it was, James Watt. It was in the 1700s, the Watt governor. I'll show you a picture of it maybe next time. It's quite a simple device. It just opens and closes the throttle according to the speed of the engine. But it's a classic example of self-regulation in its most basic, primitive form, through feedback. Yes, Tex, you want to say something, don't you?
No,
you yeah, just thinking it, yeah. But the intrinsically, so again, I keep throwing this out because I've studied cybernetics. I'm going to go, well, intrinsically regulated, well, what about the Watt governor? This is 200 years old already. But it's the sense that Heidegger wants to give here, and Jonas also, when he talks about it, has the same thing, is the sense that in the second paragraph that it drives itself. Now, there's no sense in which a steam engine has any kind of self that drives itself. The coal burns, it boils water, it produces steam, and the steam powers the engine and it turns something. And you could say, by analogy, it drives itself, but there's no experience of driving in it. Yes, again, you come to what distinguishes the living creature is it's got a drive towards something that's in some sense is teleological, in that it knows what it's driving towards. It has its own wherefore in it, and of course a drive that has its own wherefore within itself we call instinct. Again, and we say something like it's inherited. Yeah, the instinctual drives are inherited. So the self-driving and being driven towards its wherefore is only possible in as much as capability is in general instinctually driven. So not only do we have the capacity to experience colour or to hear sound or to experience the scent of something is already inherent in us, in a living being, there's also the instinctual drives, the driving towards, that's already inherent, the image of what of the prey is in the predator, and the image of the predator is in the prey. All of the life of the animal is is already pre-delineated in the instinctual drives that it doesn't learn, but it's already born with. Now, Heidegger says something here that he doesn't elucidate about the maintaining of instinctual self. This is the last paragraph. Self-driving toward its wherefore gives to capability its accomplishing character of traversing of a dimension. So you're driving towards something. He's about to say, but he doesn't say it explicitly, that this is the it's the beginning of the opening up of space for us, of the experience of space. That you're driving towards, the driving towards of an instinctual drive has something that's being driven towards that you don't have now. So it's a driving in time towards something, but you know the wherefore of it is already in you, but you don't have it now. The being driven is a driven into time and space. At being driven towards the satisfaction, really, if you like, of what the instinct is being driven toward. Do you see there's the drive is instead of the Buddha-like being of an utterly fed and happy cell, you know, which there isn't such a thing. Every living creature has to continuously struggle to maintain itself. Which means it has to reach out toward what it doesn't have. And the reaching out toward what it doesn't have, this striving, this instinctual striving, creates time and space, biologically. We didn't get to that at the end of Jonas, but he was talking about that in the last slide. That this the very experience of instinctual drivenness has a lack or an absence in it. And the lack or absence is the visceral biological ground of there being a space that you have to traverse and a time that separates you from what the drive is driving toward. Do you see the drive has space and time in it? This is the primitive origin of space and time, is the instinctual drive toward whatever it is, its own wherefore. Is it nutrition, nourishment, reproduction, or it could be a being driven away from, being driven away from discomfort, away from pain, being driven towards a state of repose in some sense. And Heidegger now wants to say something that's pertinent for us. So the drive knows what it's driving toward in advance. And the overarching drive, in a way, coordinates a whole sequence of lesser drives. The drive to flee drives the entire body, drives the behaviour of the legs and the arms, the heart, the whole nutritional state of the body, the oxygen, everything in the body. The drive coordinates the entire system towards fleeing. And these driving forces always permeate and drive on the whole movement in advance. Now, he's describing the inner being side of what it is to have drive in you. And material science would say, Darwinistic science will say, but when you study the body, you don't find anything like drive. You just find a whole series of mechanisms. One thing causes another, causes another, causes another. You remember we were thinking about the wave and saying all that wave is the molecules going up and down. When science studies an animal body, all it sees is the molecules going up and down. It doesn't see the animal fleeing. It doesn't see the drive, the drive to survive, which is the being of the animal. It just remains invisible. And Heidegger, in a certain sense, is describing what the being of the animal is, not its material manifestation. And he wants to say, in principle, and this, I want to underline this in a way, there is no mathematical expression for this instinctual structure of drives, and it is one which is incapable, in principle. He loves to repeat himself. I learned this so much about Heidegger when I create these slides, how much he repeats himself. You might check that when you read him. He often says the same thing twice. One sentence, then he says another. He says the same thing in different words in the next sentence. So he's, by saying there's no mathematical expression, he's saying that this structure of drivenness, if you're going to look at it mathematically, you're going to get to what I was talking about. There's no drive there. There's just the connection of the forces in the molecules that aren't driving towards anything.
I don't understand that, because I would have thought that if you look at something like hunger, I mean, you can, there are ways of assessing hunger, aren't there? You know, like how much saliva you're producing and what's going on in the stomach. And I mean, we can identify an organism. We can identify ourselves.
Yes, but the saliva appearing in the mouth is just molecules. The reason that the saliva appears in the mouth is you could say, you could trace it back to, there's a certain chemical state in the body that creates something that, I don't know how exactly it works, but let's assume that it's to do with the state of nutrition in the bloodstream. That when the state of nutrition in the bloodstream reaches a set, but there's no such thing as nutrition when you're looking at the atoms and molecules, right? There's a certain state of the molecular structure in the bloodstream, and when that reaches a certain point, then a certain chemical reaction occurs that causes another chemical to be released into the bloodstream that's then communicated to the brain, and the brain then, when that chemical signal arrives, it causes some through another chain of material cause and effect, saliva to be released in the mouth and all the other things that are associated with behaviour that's going to cause the animal to go and hunt for food. Mm. But all of that looked at mathematically, there was no drive in advance to do anything. Everything is just the operation, remember again, of the laws of physics. The only reason that, if you like, the animal, in our understanding, is hungry and goes and chases after food, is because that kind of molecular arrangement persists. A kind of molecular arrangement that has all of that, except it doesn't go and chase after food, doesn't persist. It starves.
Mm.
There was no drive. It's just things that don't do that don't persist. Things that do that persist. The reason that it chases after food is because that sort of structure persists. And the reason that sort of structure is there is because of the operation of natural selection and random mutation. You know the whole story.
Mm.
And if you look at things entirely mathematically, that's all you will find. And then you'll say, at a higher level, we can explain that as hunger. But the hunger is like the epiphenomenon we were talking about of our consciousness. The hunger isn't effective. What's effective are all the chemical reactions between the molecules, which have no drive, they have no foresight, they have no sense of the wherefore, of where they're going. You know, our whole concept of hunger is reflected in the physical, and we understand it from our own experience of what it's like to be hungry. But if you take away our own experience of a drive and what it's like to be hungry, you take all of that out of the equation, and you just look at the material and how it behaves mathematically, you'll just see the operation of the laws of physics. We've stumbled across this more than once, Maria.
I know.
But each time I think it's important that you see that that it's only because we project our experience into the matter that we think that the matter is expressing our experience back to us. But a purely mathematical description has already abstracted experience out of the description. So it will find no drive. We will find a drive because we've already got the idea of a drive. But where did we get the idea of a drive from? From our having, for our actually our experiencing of a drive. Where do we get the idea of hunger from? Because we know what it feels like to be hungry. And then we look for hunger in the material and we find it, right? There's something in the material that corresponds to it. But it's not hunger. What we find in the material is just a mathematical arrangement of points of force interacting with each other. Does that...
Okay. But he's not saying that you can't measure hunger in...
No, he's saying what you end up with... When you mathematize something, yeah, it's just a mathematical description of points of mass,
yeah.
And interacting with predetermined forces.
But in order to understand...
So there's no wherefore in that, there's no in advance in that, there's no intention, there's no drive, there's nothing like that. But we can, if we say, well, there is this drive, we can say... There's an in the physical, in the res extensa,
yes.
There's something that corresponds to that.
Right.
Just like the wave, you know, is just the molecules moving in the sea, but we can still study the wave.
Right. So if you're looking at somebody who's lost their appetite, and you could be able to pinpoint something that, oh, they're not producing this enzyme.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes. And nothing changes, because that's we live in this world where we have our experience, but in our science will interacts with our experiential world, and if you like translates what we say into the matter. So you say I've lost my appetite, and that gets translated into the behaviour of molecules in your body. Which have no appetite, right? The molecules have no appetite. And if they're the absolute reality, they're truly, really real, then there isn't really any appetite. There's just the appearance of appetite, like there's the appearance of a wave in the ocean. That's what he means by saying if you look at things purely mathematically, and Jonas was saying the same thing, this experiential... world of the instincts just doesn't show up, and yet this is, and so being becomes utterly flattened, and you just have the being of the material. And he wants to say something here like the capacity does not leave itself behind and does not escape itself. On the contrary, in this instinctual toward, the capacity as such becomes and remains proper to itself. So, it's not as if there's a capacity to see that flings you out of yourself into the world. Or it's not as if there's a capacity to... in a more general sense, to behave in a certain way, like to eat food and to get nutrition. The capacity always remains within itself. It knows its wherefore, it knows what it's driving towards, and it never goes beyond that. This is something crucial in what Heidegger is going to try and say about animality. The capacity doesn't have self-consciousness or reflection or any relating back to itself, because in a way it's self-encompassing. It already knows what it's driving toward. It already knows it's driving towards some form of satisfaction or some form of the ending of itself. it's almost that that instinctual drive is the elimination of a certain want. So, do you see, it doesn't, in a sense, discover anything. It already knows in advance what it's driving to.
So does he think of seeing as being a drive?
Well, no, he would say, I'm just conferring with him here, that when we talk about seeing and we talk about animal seeing, it's like the bee, we're talking about two different things. So if you're talking about seeing as in I'm looking at something and recognising it as being something, he'd say the animal isn't seeing in that way. The animal's capacity to see is entirely caught up in whatever instinctual drive is currently determining what the animal's doing.
But it's not the drive itself.
No. No, the capacity is in the service, in some sense, of the drive. And I think he talked about subservience. The drive is the central, if you like, emanation of the organism, and the capacities are subservient to the organism as a whole and subservient to the drive. Whatever the drive is driving at, the capacity to see is subservient to it. But when he starts talking about capability, it starts to move over in the capability for behaviour, which is the capability to capture prey, for instance, let's say, or the capability to reproduce. But he wants to say that the animal doesn't lose itself, in the last paragraph, in the sense that an instinctual impulse to something would leave it itself behind. Remember that we were talking about captivation here. It's like the impulse seems to be towards something other than itself.
Mm.
Yes? Like our impulse, that's how we would understand a human impulse. It's an impulse towards the being of something else. And Heidegger wants to say, no, an instinctual impulse already contains what it's driving at. It doesn't, he's going to say in some sense, it doesn't actually really reach the other. It's only, in some sense, seeking its own elimination.
What?
Elimination.
The drive is seeking to eliminate itself. It's not seeking the thing that it seems that it's driving towards. It is not driving towards an encounter with that thing as the thing that it is.
Yeah.
The drive is driving towards its own elimination, not of the thing. It might be driving towards the elimination of the, if it's going to destroy something, but it's driving towards its own. Yes.
So.
That means that the animal remains proper to itself. In some sense, he wants to say the animal remains, it's to a certain extent, encapsulated within its own instinctual drive.
So if it's going for food and it gets food,
then the drive is eliminated. Yes, the drive is eliminated itself.
You can see in domestic animals, they have a drive to go and hang out with or get affection from a particular individual.
Yes.
They're driven to a particular individual.
Yes.
They're not just driven to eliminate the need for affection. They want to be with you, don't
yes.
they?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So the drive is sensitive.
Yes.
In some sense, and is open in some sense. And you know, he's going to talk about this. You can't say the drive is not open, because the drive is, in certain sense, triggered by something particular. So it's not that the animal is cut off and knows nothing of the environment. It's the drives themselves that are sensitive or responsive to whatever. Well, I'm going to jump ahead. Whatever disinhibits the drive. Yes.
So that's you.
So it's not blind. It's not blind in that way.
Because you said that they're just chasing prey to eliminate hunger. They're not looking at a particular animal.
That was an example.
Right. Okay.
Yes, but there'll be particulars for the animal as well. There'll be the particular mate.
Yes.
Their particular offspring.
Yes.
So the particulars also are the drive can be associated with particulars as well as just the general.
Yeah. Isn't that the same for us?
Well, we're getting to that.
We are
getting to that. So he wants to say, and this is where, you know, Heidegger is often just didactic like this. He just says, this is the way it is. And don't ask me why. I just see it. The organism does not have capacities. That's a wrong way of seeing it. It is not an organism which is then additionally supplied with organs. Rather, to say the animal is organized means that the animal is rendered capable. And its being capable is what it means to be alive. Here we are with potentiality. And that implies that the animal's being is potentiality, namely the potentiality to articulate itself into capacities, into those instinctual and subservient ways of remaining proper to itself. These capacities in turn possess the possibility of allowing certain organs to arise from them. This capability articulating itself into capacities, creating organs, characterizes the organism as such. Marvelous.
Confusing.
Well, no. Do you see that the essence of crow? The essence of crow is the capacity of the instinctual being that the crow is to articulate itself into a crow's body.
No. I don't see that at all. Crow.
What is the crowness of a crow and the dogness of a dog and the catness of a cat? He's trying to get towards that.
No, I'm sorry, this doesn't make any sense to me at all.
The nest is designed to contain eggs.
Am I the only one that doesn't get this?
To protect eggs, the nest is designed.
Oh, thank you. Because I'm often left thinking I'm sort of with you.
But no, I don't like to think in those terms that you either get it or you don't get it. There's a certain poeticness here that says, will you just open yourself up to that phrase and see how it hits you, see how it strikes you? Because there's a certain level where it's not a cause and effect ABC thing here. He's saying, does this correspond in any way within you? Because we're trying to build it up, it's layer by layer, we're building it up. Do you see there's a certain capability for certain behaviours that characterises all the different animal species, and that those capabilities are in some sense are inherited? Yes? And that the animal, you can kind of damage the animal's body and stuff up the expression of those capacities, or the body might grow wrongly, but the capacities and the instincts behind them are already present. Yes?
In the DNA.
In the being. In science, it's in the DNA. But remember, the DNA is just the mathematicized version of that. That says, because the DNA has this structure, the body grows in that way. And by the way, that's still a conjecture, that DNA can actually explain morphogenesis. But what Heidegger's saying is, no, but that, there's no capacity to see in the DNA. There isn't. There's just a bunch of molecules. There's no capacity to feel hunger in the DNA, is there?
No.
I mean, there's a way that you could say there is, a very convoluted way, but you get the idea. He's not talking about that. He's saying, no, there's already the proper being of a particular species of cat, and all of the potentialities for the way that that cat can express itself in its capacities to stalk a mouse and to climb a tree, and how it's going to behave when it mates, and all of the rest of it, the whole what it means to be a cat, the whole way the cat's going to purr, it's all predelineated. And it articulates itself into the cat's body. And if the cat's body grows okay, then all of those instinctual predelineated instinctual behaviours are going to manifest themselves. And that's what a cat is. Let's not say designed yet. Let's not say where that came from. I mean, I just like to say it came from the collective experience of all of the species that articulated itself in different ways. And one of the ways it articulated itself was into catness.
Even the first clause, you know, the organism doesn't have capacities. I thought you'd just been saying it does.
It does not have capacities in the sense that it is an organism which is then additionally supplied with organs.
Oh, okay.
What he wants to say is it does not have, that's why I've indicated have, like the capacities are not additional things that a central thing that is an organism already has. Without capacities, it isn't an organism.
Right.
The organism, in some sense, is its capacities. So it's,
but I thought you,
it's the have word.
I thought you were supposed to think that it's more than the sum of its parts. So it can't just be its capacities. It must be more than that. Surely.
Yes. Yeah.
So
I think so too.
Is the wrong verb then?
But that it's more than the sum of its parts doesn't mean that it's a thing to which capacities are added.
No, it's a thing that contains capacities.
But even then, that sort of indicates that it's distinct from its capacities. And Heidegger wants to say, no, the being of the animal being is not distinct from its having capacities.
Okay.
Animal being is having capacities.
Okay.
He's attacking a certain subject predicate way of thinking that says there's a thing and it has all these attributes. And he's saying, no, the very being of an animal is the being of the capacities that it has. And an animal that has no capacities is dead. And something which, the last line, does not exist in the manner of being capable cannot be dead either. So a stone can't be dead.
Only the Schrodinger cat. Cat, do you know the mechanical quantum?
Schrodinger's cat.
Yes, yeah, Schrodinger's cat. The one that is going to be killed by the if a certain atomic radioactive element decays, then the cat dies. It releases gas in the cat in the containers. You know the Schrodinger cat thing, yeah. And it's neither dead or alive until someone observes it. However, the answer to that is in some sense, if the cat has any kind of consciousness, then it will observe the decay. So the cat has to be asleep. But is anything ever utterly asleep that's alive? So we cannot explain escaping and pursuing simply by applying theoretical mathematics or mechanics, however complex. The escaping worm does not merely appear within the context of a sequence of movements which begin with the mole. Rather, the worm is escaping from the latter. We're back at what we were talking about earlier. I feel like Maria's the one I have to tell this to.
Sorry.
But I'm telling everyone else as well. If we just look at it mathematically, the worm's movements is just a sequence of activities that are determined by the laws of physics of the molecules that make up its body. It is not escaping. Or if it's escaping, it's only escaping according to a meaning that we're putting on it. But what Heidegger's saying is, no, the worm is a living being that has its instinctual drives that are articulated into its body. It is escaping. A mathematical or mechanical account of what's happening in its body will not discover any escaping. So we see here a self-like behaviour, a kind of a drive to what only at the very end he finally admits is towards self-preservation. But it's because he hates to use any of the language of conventional science, especially Darwinistic science. So it's Britishers. Yeah, I hate the Darwinists. I especially hate the British. Anyway.
He's not saying will either.
No, it's just the instinctual drive is a drive to escape that's articulated into the body that has the capacity for the worm to move. He's saying it's not coming from the physics, it's not coming from the material, it's coming from the being, the animal being. And in a way, obviously, do you see, there's a certain level here where if we hadn't have all been subjected to 400 years of science, we'd just be yawning and saying, well, why are you bothering to tell us this? It's because we have this overarching materialistic scientific explanation of everything that in some sense just skips over this. And says, oh, there are drives, but what it is really is the behaviour of the cells, the molecular behaviour of the cells in the worm's body. And the scientific explanation says you can call it escaping if you like, but there's nothing more to it than the mechanics.
Well, it is escaping from the worm's point of view, isn't it?
Yes, but the fact that the worm has a point of view means we're talking about the being of the worm.
Yes.
In fact, it has a point of view.
Yes.
And if you look at it entirely in terms
doesn't
of theory...
Doesn't science look at that?
Now, you've got to be clear here. Of course the scientist thinks in those terms.
Yeah.
But the mathematical description
doesn't.
The personal scientist thinks in those terms, but the formalism that the scientist uses to understand things doesn't.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that, because I've never studied science.
No, but even... Your depression is caused by a deficiency of a certain chemical in your brain, let's say.
Mm.
That's an entirely materialistic explanation of your depression. Now, the person... There's the doctor or the person in the drug company who's doing that obviously understands that your depression was probably caused by something that happened to you and da 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 da, and has a whole psychic understanding of that. But the people who are making the drugs are just looking at the behaviour of the molecules.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes? And it's the behaviour of the molecules that determines the investment of the drug company.
Wouldn't they say something like...
But that doesn't mean that you go in there and you talk to someone who's developing the drugs and they say, oh, depression isn't real. There's no such thing as depression. There's only the molecules. They won't. We understand things on multiple levels. Right. So it'd be incorrect. Of course, neuroscientists studying the brain will talk about your experiences, and just as everybody else does. But finally, it's to do with what is ultimately real in that understanding. And what is ultimately real in that understanding is what is efficacious. Yes, what causes what.
Mm.
And at the bottom of that understanding, despite all the aversions that, oh yes, no, I'm taking your experience into account, but in fact, it's, like I said last week, it's an epiphenomenal experience that we grant a certain reality to, but it's not ultimately real. The ultimate reality isn't the wave, it's the molecules moving up and down in the water. The ultimate reality isn't your feeling of depression, it's the chemical imbalance in your brain. It's a fine distinction here, because sometimes you think that there's a bunch of people, scientists, who are sitting around thinking, the only thing I ever talk about is molecules. Now, and there are people like that, you know, but they're a minority. Most people kind of blend the two worlds together, yes, in a way that they probably haven't sufficiently reflected on.
Right. Okay.
Because scientists aren't philosophers. You know, they behave in a certain way when they're in the lab and doing their work and writing their papers, and then they go home and have dinner and say, shut up, you're irritating me. They don't say, I've got a chemical imbalance in my, you know... You see, it's not as clear-cut as... I make it sound clear-cut because I'm talking about this level... It's this level of what is ultimately real that still is informing the way that we understand things when it comes to our technology, our investments, the decisions that we make in this world. Have I got... Oh yeah, here we start, right? Capability is instinctual, a driving forward and maintaining oneself in being driven toward that which the capability is capable of. I hope you've got enough Heidegger now to look at a sentence like that and say, well, yes, that sounds quite reasonable.
The capacity is capable of
toward a possible form of behaviour. Right now, the end of it all is what is the drive resulting in? It's resulting in behaviour. The behaviour of the animal is not a doing and acting as in human comportment, but a driven performing. Instinctual drivenness characterises all such animal performance. All right? That what does it mean to be an animal is starting to emerge now. It's a driven performing. Already there's a sense, you see, this is the first mention of human comportment. Our doing and acting is not a driven performing. Most of the time. Some of the time, maybe.
Yeah.
But we the very fact that we can distinguish between a driven performing and not being driven means that we have a certain distance off from this from being determined by our instinctuality. And this is the distinction Heidegger wants to make. But at the same time, he wants us in some sense to enter into what this means to be instinctually driven. And he wants to call this form of being, of being instinctually driven, as captivation. And then he wants to say, if you're captivated, then you're only ever going to encounter an environment and not a world. And in a way, Heidegger's saying, why? Because I'm defining it so. To a certain extent, he's saying, what I mean by world, this is one way that I want to illuminate it to you. Captivation is not some state that accompanies the animal, which it sometimes temporarily falls, nor is it a state in which it simply finds itself permanently. It is the inner possibility of animal being itself. Which means for Heidegger, if an animal ever were to, in some sense, break out of this captivation of instinctual behaviour, it would no longer be an animal. Which is, earlier we were looking at that, that's maybe the possibility for some of the chimpanzees and maybe the dolphins. Maybe there's a possibility there at the higher end of the animals that exhibit the most complex forms of behaviour. Maybe they're on the cusp of what he means by this captivation. So the driven activity and behaviour of the bee is not governed by any recognition of the presence or absence of that which it is driven to engage with. In sucking at the blossom, the bee does not comport itself toward the blossom as something present or not present. The activity here is terminated through an inhibition, drive and disinhibition. That means the activity does not simply cease, rather the drivenness of the capability is redirected into another drive. In this case, flying back to the beehive, if you read it. The flight back to the hive is just as captivated as with the as was the sucking. But Heidegger spends a long time recognising that the bee, in some sense, is referred to, is in some sense open to the flower and to the hive. It's not that it doesn't come into contact with something. It's not blind or indifferent. It sees in the sense that it discriminates and is responsive to the environment. But something's missing. And Heidegger's, I feel with Heidegger, he's trying to point out there's something missing. Do you see what it is? If you see what's missing, you see what it is to be a human being. You see what it is to have a world. I can't tell you direct. I'm saying, do you have an intuitive sense of what this instinctual drivenness is? So, in all its instinctual activity, the bee is related to its feeding place, to the sun, to the hive, and so forth. In fact, I'm reminded now, I know Mr. Bee Man, Srinivasan, I think he was Srinivasan. He's at the University of Queensland, probably the world's foremost expert on bees. I do know him. He loves bees. He's just amazed by bees and how they navigate and what they do and how sophisticated they are and how, despite all of the technology, all of the computational power, everything that we've kind of achieved, because he used to like to taunt me, you know, what's artificial intelligence hasn't even got an inch, you know, a centimetre towards the capability of a single bee.
They don't, don't they?
Sorry.
Yes.
Youngest. No, I wanted. I try to understand this also like a lack of freedom. This is animal behavior.
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, but then that's you've got to really understand what it's. A lack of freedom to do what? See, Heidegger's not saying, in a way, it's to do with freedom, but he's saying no. It's essentially it's to do with our ability, that we're open in another way. That we're actually open to being. That we. I mean, another person that I knew had another way of putting this. He said, and I was reviewing this, that at a certain, it's a myth, at a certain point in time, maybe a long time ago, 100,000 years ago, maybe longer, there was an event in the East where an early human saw the sunrise for the first time, as in saw the sun, that instead of just being in this instinctual captivation, suddenly realized, without having necessarily having language in the way that we have it, there's the sun. I'm not driven towards it. I've got no feelings about it. I'm not involved in any instinctual activity at the moment. Suddenly it penetrated through the behaviours, the instinctual behaviours in which I've been living and living, it, kind of almost asleep. Suddenly there's the sun. Yeah, I'm living it now. I can feel the shivers. You know? The sun. You know, you want to say, they didn't have the word fuck, but you know, fuck. There's the sun, you know. And it actually, and it's, you sort of, you, the next thing you say, it's been there all the time, but I never noticed. I never noticed. Not just the sun, but fuck. Here's the earth. Do you know? I've just been chasing after animals, you know, feeding, copulating, you know, like a dog, you know. And suddenly, just one morning, and he actually, Barry mentioned it as the penetration of the veil of opaqueness, that actually our entire instinctual life is kind of encapsulated by a certain veil of opaqueness, so that we're caught within these engagements with things, captivated within them, but we don't see the earth, we don't see the beings around us. And the seeing of the beings around us is the having of a world. Forget language, but language, immediately that you have that, you're going to have language. Without that, you aren't. So the bee, in all of its relating to, it is relating to stuff, but it's only relating to the stuff that's almost pre-delineated in its instinctual world. But you can't say world. Yes, in its instinctual organisation already pre-delineates what it's going to respond to. Heidegger's going to say something. It's never going to encounter the flower as a flower. The flower is going to encounter the flower as what it's driving toward. It's the drive that holds it, and the flower is the elimination of the drive. But as long as it's encapsulated in the drive, it's not going to see the flower as a flower. In certain sense, it's going to have some experience of the flower, but it's not going to see the flower as a flower. It's not going to recognize the being of beings. You know, this is one of Heidegger's core phrases, the being of beings. And we're living the being of beings every second. Just, if you just get into this animal state, you appreciate the animal state, suddenly it's the idea should go bing. It's amazing that we hear, we behold the earth. It isn't, you know, we think we just open our eyes and there it is. But it's not. It's an extraordinary achievement of life on earth to have produced something like us that can recognize the being of other beings. That there are other beings here. I mean, it's a, do you get it?
Well, I get it because I experience food. When I'm really hungry, I don't see, like, I wouldn't see the nut as a nut. It'd just be like, grab it and stuff it in my mouth because I'm hungry.
Yes.
But if I'm not hungry, I can look at it and contemplate it.
Yes.
And see it as a nut.
Because there's a myth here. I mean, this is Jung's myth. I've been studying Jung, so I'll give you Jung's myth. Jung's myth is this is the purpose. This is our purpose. This life on earth, in some sense, intended there to be a being here that sees and experiences the being of nature. You know, nature was nature itself, if you like, the evolution of the species is all caught up in this instinctual realm, and it doesn't know itself. It doesn't experience itself except through these instinctual drives. So in a certain sense it's asleep. And our very purpose is to have emerged out of that sleep and just to behold, just to apprehend. Nature wanted to be apprehended, and we do it. And you see, it's not a purpose like I'm going to be a politician, I'm going to change the world. You know, just our appreciation, and you don't have to love it or appreciate it, but in a certain sense, if you get to the core of what it is, you'll find, I think, that you do love it. The earth. You know, the earth. We all have that somewhere, don't we? This love of the earth. And almost it's like the earth, in some sense, the impulse of the earth was to bring it about that somewhere in the evolution of the species, something would emerge whereby something that was potential could manifest. And we are that. And we are manifesting it. And our manifesting it is a blooming miracle.
It's a pity that the understanding of the biological investigation went to the direction of Darwinism.
I'm glad you said that and not me. But do you see? Because that's exactly it. Do you see what an extraordinary story it is? The evolution of the species and the production of self-conscious intelligence on Earth. It's just amazing, right? But what we've made of it is, oh no, it's just a kind of a machine run by the laws of physics, you know, without any meaning or any internal. There's nothing going on. It's got.
So what is it that wanted us to be conscious then?
I feel like playing a horror. It was the Catholic God. It was Jesus. It was Jesus. Jesus loves you. No.
Can't we? Something. I mean,
I know where you're coming from. Yeah. Have I nailed it? Are we back in church, you're wondering?
Yeah.
Yes.
Saying there's a teleology.
I'm saying thou art that. I'm not saying there's a God in the sky. I'm saying thou art that. I'm not claiming anything over there. I'm saying in one's very beholding of the earth, that whatever it is that you are what's beholding the earth. There's no God over there who intended you. You are a kind of an illusion. You know, the beholding is some happening, whatever you think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, can I say this?
So it's not necessary, and it's not Jesus.
No. <don't> Jesus. But Jesus was quite a nice guy.
It's
just the understanding we're talking about, rather than just saying da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
So we're just instruments.
Well, no,
that illuminate universal consciousness, that kind of stuff.
We're not saying that we're phenomenologists. If we've got to the point where we've got to, we just realise that that's what we do.
Yeah.
We experience what Heidegger calls the manifestness of being.
Yeah.
And that in terms of being a purpose, if we fully inhabit that, it's just a self-fulfilling state. And to say that some intelligence intended that is just as much as to say, well, I am that intelligence. I'm experiencing that this was, in some sense, a potentiality that was already there. I'm just experiencing that. I am it. It doesn't need to go any further than that. We don't need to say there's a God in heaven who had a plan that this was all going to happen this way. That's just speculation. Yeah? So we're not doing any speculating about this. We're sticking with, if we can get the realization that of what it means to experience the manifestness of being, that's it. That's good enough.
I once had two hash cakes. And I thought about this.
Yeah, there, yes. Yeah. You sure you want this to be on tape? Yeah. Yes.
And I understood it, but the next day when I woke up, I just forgot all about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's come back to you now. Yes. So you can either do, you know, about 40 hours of philosophy, or have two hash cakes. You know, it's your choice, isn't it?
Pints of homebrew and a whole of Earth's knowledge.
No, I fear homebrew isn't quite the right, doesn't not quite the right attunement. So this, you know, there's a danger here, a deep danger that I'm going to get to the end of my slides before 2 o'clock. Wouldn't that be shocking? Yeah, So we're trying to make a distinction now between a behaving and an apprehending. Heidegger doesn't want to use the word self-consciousness, right? That we're self-conscious in a way that the animals aren't. You see, he's driving at something. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that we think. It doesn't mean that we are able to reflect on the past. It's actually an entirely new state of being on Earth. It's the realization of the being of beings, that there are beings here. The crucial thing is to see that it's an event to know that. So the animals, in some sense, have that withheld. That's how he wants to talk about it. That the possibility is not given at all, or taken away from the animal. And now it's because the animal is taken and captivated by things, captivated by that which disinhibits its drives. So the animal is a kind of prisoner to what is predelineated in the drives. It can only respond or behave according to what is predelineated. Now, there's more to come, because we haven't got to the disinhibiting ring yet. What is present at hand means what is present at hand in its being present at hand as a being. Beings are not manifest to the behaviour of the animal in its captivation. They are closed off to it, and for that very reason are not closed off from it either. This is a classic Heidegger. In order for something to be closed off to you, there has to be the possibility that it isn't closed off. Yes? So he's saying it's not really correct to say that possibility is closed off to the animal, because that means we could eliminate that, but he wants to say that it's actually in the essence of the animal being, that the being of beings is not manifest to the animal. Although he does talk later, and I don't quote it, about St. Paul mentioning about the yearning of the beasts, that there is a certain that sometimes you might be able to detect a certain yearning of the animal towards a state of being present in the way that we are. I don't know, that was just, I only mentioned that in passing because I sometimes get the sense of that in the eyes of a dog or a cow, that there's some sort of dim sense in there of a sort of a wanting to come to the light, you know, wanting to come to the light, but it's there's, and that veil of opaqueness that I mentioned, you can almost see it in the eye, that it can't quite break through into the, and it's in the eye, I mean, that you really see it, you know, when you look at someone and they look back at you.
The windows.
Yeah, yeah. There's a I see you, you see me. Do you know?
And I get that with animals.
Well, you check it out again. You see the animal. Does the animal see you? And then just double check by looking at a person and see if you can see, experience the distinction.
Well, I don't know, because I mean, I lived for 20 years with a cat. And this cat had me trained good and proper, and it knew exactly what to do. Sometimes it would decide at 5 o'clock in the morning it wanted breakfast. So it would come into my bedroom. I tried shutting it out, but it would dig up the carpet and scratch on the door, so it was easy.
Yeah, true, but that's... Yes.
And it had taught itself to put on my bedside light with its teeth, because it knew that
yes.
sometimes worked. It also taught itself that if it went up onto my dressing table, meowed loudly, looked at me, and if I didn't get up, it would bat something off, and then wait, and if I still didn't get up, it would look at me, meow, and bat the next thing off. And it was looking at me, going, you know, I could see it was driven by, if you like, the hunger, and it wanted its breakfast.
Yes.
But there was an interaction going on, and it knew that eventually it went through a various
yes,
stages
yes.
of the, getting me
everything
out of
good, everything good. So, but are you getting the distinction
yeah.
that it's open to you? It
yeah.
it recognizes you,
yeah.
and you are the trigger that's going to produce the food.
Mm.
Yes, of course it's going to look at you. Of course it's going to look at you. A tiger's going to look at an antelope. Well, I don't think they have antelopes necessarily. A tiger's going to look at whatever, and you know, the prey is going to look at the tiger, right? And there's going to be, I know you're a tiger, and the cat's going to know that you're the source of food, but we're talking about this recognition of being. Yeah, I know, but you're talking about the behaviour. In a sense, it's I'm talking about there's a psychic difference in looking into the eye of an animal and looking into the eye of a human being. Not that some human beings don't look at you when they look at you, right? It's not as if it always happens. But if somebody if you really look at somebody and they look back at you. There's the recognition of a certain that there's I don't know how to put it any different that I know you're there, you know I'm here, and you also know that you're there, and know that I'm here, and we know it's not thoughtful, I'm not thinking that, I'm actually experiencing your being there. I'm experiencing your being conscious of me. And when I look into an animal's eyes, and this is all I can say, I don't, the spark is of that isn't there. Now the animal recognizes me in that sense with quotes around it. It knows me in relation to what to like the cat, in relation to its desire for food. And not only that, sometimes with the dog, of course, and the cat, there's a desire just for nuzzling up. So it's not about the behaviours, it's about and something that you can't express. Or if it is about the behaviour, it's to do with the fact that the cat doesn't say get up? Does it say get up? The behaviour is the cat doesn't have language in that sense, that addresses you as the being that you are. You have to first have that.
I'm not convinced, because I think if the cat had got the same vocal cords as we have, it would have said effing get up. Because it certainly meowed. And
now, I'm asking everyone here to look again at that, because the cat would, if the cat could, if it had a little keyboard here and it could press, get up please, I want food, it would do that, right? But it's learnt a behaviour. You see the distinction, you could get the cat to go with vocal cords, and if it was capable of saying get up, it would say get up. But we're talking about something else here.
It would say, you, Maria, get up.
But it doesn't matter.
It would have to
recognize your being rather than you as a
provider of food.
Yeah.
I think it
it would recognize you, your body. It would recognize your body. It would be able to associate the name Maria, everything. But it wouldn't recognize your being. And this is the absolutely fine distinction that we're getting at here, that you can't explain. There's no behaviour that is going to exemplify that, because we can make a machine talk language as well.
If we stayed at your house, Maria, and you were away, your pussycat would sort of start saying, we stayed in a villa in southwest France. There's a little pussycat.
Yeah.
Soon got the hang of us.
Yeah. No, I was studying how it does. It's
it. Training.
Yeah. No, it is training. It is training. It's exactly training, and it's going that if you're not on the animal, it will train you. If you're just passive, and we tend to be that way because we project a kind of a human intelligence into them. And we expect them to behave decently, you know, don't we? I hope everyone kind of gets this. Heidegger and I are trying to express something that if you can enter into this sense of what it's like to be instinctually driven, then you grasp in that state there's a privation of something, right? And as soon as you see what the privation is, you get the essence of what it is to be Dasein, what distinguishes us from the animals. I did know that we would probably get into an argument about my pet. But finally, I guess it's something that you have to demonstrate to yourself about in your interaction with an animal. I suggest, if it isn't super clear, that we all, you know, part of your homework for this week is to reappraise the any animals that you come across. You know what. See if you can sense the distinction between your being and the being and the animal being that's in front of you. But watch out for looking at dogs too carefully in their eyes, because it unsettles them. Yeah, they can get nasty, especially if they think that you've got a bit of fear in you. So I don't want to be, you know, I feel like I'm the lecturer now. Of course, there's a safety warning here. Don't stare for a long time at a dangerous dog.
I got that completely with my guinea pigs. They were not seeing me. They were not apprehending.
Yes, but it's true. I think it's true with the guinea pigs that they didn't have the capacity to distinguish you from someone else. But the cat does. It's not about, I've got a special behaviour for you, Maria. Or even that the dogs, I mean, Rupert Sheldrake has this, that animals know that you're coming home before they could possibly have any You know, they've got a psychic attunement about that.
I've seen evidence.
So that's not to say that the, and Heidegger says this in one place, that's not to say that we're, that the animals are living in an impoverished state. You know, they are probably in their instinctualness in touch with a whole lot of information that we in our little narrow consciousness are blocking out. Do you know that they'll be picking stuff up, but they won't know. They won't know it in the way that we do. They'll just be responsive to it.
I sometimes see the baboons like that, not out of all the apes. The baboons, they have really deep stare and very kind of conscious kind of. You feel their agony.
Yes, because that's where I'm not clear. The next thing is Nicola and I are going to have to adopt a great ape. I know, it's just to study this.
I find the baboons in particular. I kind of like, I think they're all also like, I feel like they're more like similar to us than the chimps or the bonobos or the gorillas. They're more similar to our situation. And their behavior is very similar to our behavior. They have jealousy, they experience a lot of things that we experience.
But I mean, Heidegger's almost saying that the, you know, the experience of being human you're not going to be able to distinguish it in terms of a certain sophistication of behaviour, except in so far as we create something like language. That the fact that we created that is a sign, but. Does the fact we use it isn't a sign, because animals can copy our use of language to an extent. So there's no the being jealous, the, you know, the social behaviours of apes, none of that demonstrates that beings are manifest to the apes. But I'm leaving the apes in a kind of a, who knows, there may be some fluidity there, and maybe things aren't static either, because the earth is a different earth now for the great apes, because we're here, you know, and we've probably changed what's possible for them.
There was this female baboon, and she was like sitting by the river like that, and she was maybe quite bored, so she started like playing with the river and like watching all the ripples going like that, doing it again and just watching the ripples. Which animal does
that? Is it a wave or molecules, she was thinking?
No, she was watching.
Yeah. Spot on. Spot on, Maria. That's right. Yeah.
So she was experiencing kind of like philosophical behavior. Watching the beauty of the ripples. Experiencing the beauty.
Yes. So, and if that is in fact what was happening, that's it, right? The being of the ripples is manifest then. That's what we're talking about.
She didn't need anything from it.
She wasn't fishing anything. She was just watching the ripples and just doing it again and watch it again.
But I think the crucial sort of psychic thing is in the eye contact. That's where I would make my final judgment on Herman the Schnauzer, you know, and it wasn't happening.
Yeah, if there's another baboon in the room, I would feel that there's another person. It's like when there's another animal in the room, you feel, just an animal.
But yeah, that's
a baboon. You feel like it's a person.
Yeah, I had a moment of with a deer. We were living in California, and the deer used to come to get apples off us. And I had just that. I thought, I really don't care what this deer thinks of me. Do you know, if I just sit here and fart, or, you know, whatever I do, I really don't. It's like there's nothing, there's nobody there, and I'm just not, you know, I'm not relating in that way. And that, in a way, that was a realization. Oh God, of course, when there's a self-conscious being there, I know I'm being reflected, and it changes the way I am. Yeah, that's another way of saying it. Do you get embarrassed if you do something in front of your cat? That's another test.
I don't necessarily get embarrassed if I do something in front of a person.
Yes.
not a test at all.
I think there'll be some acts you'd rather not be observed doing, but let's not go into that. But would you care if the cat saw you? That's the question.
No, of course not. The cats don't have the same they don't have the same kind of values that we do.
But I put it to you, Maria, that it's more than that. It's that the cat isn't registering you as another being. Okay, so the disinhibiting ring, this is his kind of, this is the concept, if you like, that sticks in my mind. The totality of its self-absorbed capability is an interrelated drivenness of instinctual drives. It's wonderful language, isn't it? I wish we could say it in German. You can imagine the sense.
It has more like an orchestra.
Yeah, but it sounds German almost. It's as close as you get German to English. So the totality of its self-absorbed capability, and they love a long sentence, right? Sorry, any Germans who may be listening. That's probably why they're so good at philosophy, because they have such long sentences and they wait for the end of the sentence before the verb turns up. It kind of means they can think more effectively, probably. I wouldn't be surprised. Let me try this sentence again. The totality of its self-absorbed capability is an interrelated drivenness of the instinctual drives which encircles the animal. It does so in such a way that it is precisely this encirclement which makes possible the behaviour in which the animal is related to other things, although these other things are not manifest as beings. That which the animal's behaviour relates to is such that this behaviour is open to it, like the cat is open to Maria. The other is taken up into this openness of the animal in a manner that we shall describe as disinhibition. So the picture is the animal is encircled by this ring of instinctual drives that are interrelated. They're not isolated, because one is connected to another and a whole series may be enacted in a certain sequence of behaviour. But the animal is entirely encircled by this set of instinctual drives and behaviours, and it can the only way that the earth, if you like, what is, can get to the animal is through the ring. And the only way that the animal can relate to the what we call the world is through the ring. So the ring determines how the animal can behave, and it determines what the animal is open to or for. So do you see the sense that he's trying to give a sense of the captivation, of the encirclement? That outside, we know outside is the blessed earth. I'm sorry, I don't get religious. You know, all things bright and beautiful. That's sorry.
So the animal encapsulates the drive.
Well, it's encircled. It's encircled by a ring of disinhibition, right? So its entire commerce with what lies outside is through the disinhibition of the ring. And if something doesn't disinhibit the ring, then the animal has no behaviour and no relation to it. And he was influenced by Jakob von Uxkull, who is a biologist of that period, who is still very well regarded, because he tried to draw the environment of animals, draw and describe the environment of different animals, to try and give the idea of that they live in entirely different worlds to us, according to what they're responsive to.
But aren't they open to things that do not satisfy their drive simply by understanding that it's not food, or it's not a predator, or it's not something that I can sit on? It must make a distinction. By making a distinction, you've got a ring of drives, and something disinhibit that ring, like a peanut. Oh, I can eat that, right? But this doesn't, so I won't relate to it.
But remember, it doesn't go, oh, a peanut.
No.
The peanut only impinges.
Yes.
It's not, the animal doesn't see the peanut as a peanut. the peanut disinhibits.
But it must be aware of this as not food. This is not food.
Well, no, that just doesn't impinge. It doesn't disinhibit.
Well, you can see animals trying different things, putting things up to their mouths, and oh no.
Yeah, so that it appeared like food.
Mm.
And so it disinhibited the drive to pick it up. And then at a certain point it turned out not to be food, so the drive was redirected.
And also learning that some things are poisonous.
Yes.
So it must be, would you say that's disinhibiting its drive to survive?
Well, it will have a drive to eat, and then it eats, but if it's also got an... a drive to avoid toxic food.
But it has to learn that, doesn't it?
Yes. Now, we're not... This isn't saying the animal doesn't learn. But its capacity to learn is encapsulated within its drives, its instinctual drives. Its instinctual drives determines what it can learn.
Mm-hmm.
So learning is just a restructuring of the body, if you like. And learning is a capacity as well, of course. A capacity to restructure the body. But the capacity of the body to be restructured is entirely determined or enslaved or captivated by the drives.
Don't you think we're a bit the same?
We are to an extent, yes. Mm. Yes, it's almost that our capacity to consciously recognise the manifestness of being is we rarely recognize it, but we do in a sense. It's in us. We comport ourselves towards other human beings as the beings that they are, whether we consciously realize it or not. So it's not a matter of consciously reflecting and realizing it. We comport ourselves to the beings of other beings. We understand being already. It's in what I was saying just now. It's in our being embarrassed at somebody seeing us do something that we feel ashamed about.
We learn that. It's not in our being.
No, but we it's in us. The sense of being looked at.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at something like that, those programs that Attenborough did about individual animals, and the one about the
Attenborough.
Okay, I'm not saying, but it was very interesting that he followed the lives of one particular.
It's not that I dislike him, but
he
was the first person I ever met that doesn't like David Attenborough. Sorry, I'm
being
interrupted.
Yeah,
I thought he was widely regarded as somebody that everybody loved.
No, there's nobody's loved by everybody. That's the proof.
I think it's incredible.
I feel like a terrible disappointment.
Yeah, there's the CEO of Mobil Oil. He's not so keen on Attenborough either.
Oh. Yes. I mean, he did this. He followed this particular chimp who was the leader of a pack, and had not bothered to make allies, a large number of allies in the pack. And consequently, when his leadership was challenged by the younger males, who really duffed him up and injured him very badly, he went off and waited for his wounds to heal. When he came back, he spent a long time making allies in the pack with some of the older chimps that would not be likely to threaten him in his position. And then when the next attack came, all these chimps gathered together and protected him. And I'm thinking, isn't that being able to appreciate the being of another, apprehending another being?
You weren't thinking that at the time, though. You're only thinking that now.
I'm thinking of that now. Yes. I'm reinterpreting what I was watching. As a way of saying, well, I think Heidegger hasn't drawn the line. He draws the line between humans and animals, and I'm saying this line is not that clear.
Yeah, well, we're not arguing with that in relation to the higher apes. Although I would probably, if I was forced to argue with you there, I think the only place that the boundary is going to become questionable is with apes who interact with humans a lot.
We talk about a certain quality that the humans might reach this quality, and maybe other animals can reach it too. But
so no amount of sophisticated behaviour is going to, of the kind that you're mentioning, is going to be kind of convincing. We have to approach this from within. And the entire point of it isn't really about whether Heidegger's drawn the line in exactly the right place. It's the recognition of what it is to have a world that we're driving at, and that's what he's driving at. It's the whole book is world finitude and what was the third one, Nicola?
Oh,
there it is.
World finitude and solitude.
Solitude.
But it was apparently the lecture was world finitude and individuation at the time.
Yes.
That's
yes. So this is all part of he's asking a question: what is world? What is the worldhood of the world? And him just saying it's the manifestness of being. He was saying, well, that how do I get that across to you? Here's another way. Let's look at the being of animals. Let's look at the being of those that don't have world. And I think, you know, you can challenge him, but his insight is still true. You can challenge him on the details. The only question we have really is whether certain animals are able to get out of the ring. And whether the ring is an appropriate picture. I think the ring is a compelling picture. Finally, I think the neuroscience will probably be able to show you the physical structures in the processes going on in the animal brain that will correspond to this. And then materialistic science will say, it's all right, we've explained it, but they'll still have no idea about the manifestness of being in having done that. But there isn't. You see, neuroscience is going to be able to confirm or disconfirm this. If it gets far enough, it'll say, oh yes, this is what instinct is, and this is the kind of behaviour that human beings are capable of doing. And none of the animals are, or are. No, there'll be a signature in the brain that corresponds to what we're talking about. So, and in a way, you can't expect Heidegger to get it perfect, purely from a kind of a mixture of a study of language and a sort of introspection and a knowledge of just being with dogs and cats, which is what most of us have, and sheep and cows, and the birds. So, just to clarify it a bit further, that which disinhibits and releases the inhibitedness of the instinctual drive, which allows the instinctual activity to respond, and thus allows the animal to move, must always, in accordance with its essence, withdraw itself. It is nothing enduring that could stand over against the animal as a possible object. The self-withdrawal of that which disinhibits corresponds to the essential inability to attend to it, which is involved in animal behaviour. That is, the inability to attend to that which disinhibits as something objectively present at hand. So this is just saying the same thing again. Yes, that the animal is only sensitive to what is predelineated in its instinctual drives. And that which releases the drive withdraws from it, because the animal is caught up in its drive, and in some sense is always eliminating whatever it is that has triggered it. And this is more just saying the same in a way. The circumcised range, circumscribed, not circumcised. They're close, but not close enough. Sorry to give you that image. The circumscribed range of possible disinhibition is intrinsic to the animal itself and its factical life. And in its factical life, it carves out a quite specific encircling ring within which it can be stimulated. Remember, he was in the era of stimulus and response as well, yeah. Behaviorism.
Skinner.
Skinner, yeah. So it's the... And in a way, this is quite Skinnerian, Skinnerian. The behaviorist understood behavior in this way, the stimulus and response mechanism, if you like. So he's influenced by that, because we have a more sophisticated understanding of animal behavior now, because we understand more about how the brain functions. But nonetheless, it's still a way of understanding. I mean, but the link between stimulus and response, of course, is the brain. And behaviorism was an attempt to do neuroscience without looking at brains. You know, try and work out what the connection is between those two.
In the brain, there are as many more pathways as there are molecules.
Yes.
McGilchrist.
Yes, yeah, I know. There are trillions of connections, and the patterns that they can form are almost uncountable.
So there is some kind of a desire to become free from stimulus.
What the brain enables is a more and more refined response to the stimulus.
Mm.
But I think I want to talk in the next lectures about what we think the brain is doing. At the moment, we're sort of ascending the scale from inorganic to organic last week. Now we're going from organic in terms of single cellular basic life to what's the difference between animal life and the conscious life of the human being. But the point of this is that the animal's world, environment, set of possible behaviours is circumscribed in advance by these drives, by the inheritance of these drives. In some sense, you could say the animal is captivated in its past, but that's not strictly true. It's more that it has to evolve. It's the story of it is in Darwinism in a way. You know, the animals, in order to for the drives to change, the animal body has to change, and in order for the animal body to change, then evolution has to work, and it works very slowly. And in some sense, you could say the other sign that the human being has broken out of that is human culture and the speed with which that changes. You know, even though you could still say we're determined by the past, we don't have to wait for our bodies to change in order for our behaviours to change. We're not circumscribed in the way that the animals are. Then he's got something here saying, life is nothing but. Now, I'm shocked to hear Heidegger say nothing but, because nothing butness is a kind of a classical... That's the materialistic scientists. Yeah. Life is nothing but the behaviour of molecules. You know, there's nothing else. So maybe Heidegger's trying to get. As soon as somebody says nothing but, you can be fairly assured that they're telling you a fib. So, and here's Heidegger doing it. Maybe it was his translator. You'd have to go back to the German to see if he said nothing but. Life is nothing but the animal's encircling itself and struggling. That's an interesting word, yes? With its encircling ring a ring by way of which the animal is absorbed without its ever being with itself in the proper sense. Without its ever being with itself in the proper sense is realizing its own being. Again, that like we do realize that our being here, even if we can't express it, we know it. You know, Heidegger's always talking about this, that we have a certain knowledge that isn't born of reflection, that is just, we just have it. It's part of our understanding of being. Yes, but in a sense, as Maria, I think, mentioned earlier, it's historical still. You know, it's come out of the past. Because, you know, the wolf girl doesn't have a world. So we got a world from...
She has a wolf world.
She has a wolf environment. Well, we have to meet Wolf Girl and see, looking carefully into her eyes, see if we can make any kind of recognition there. I mean, I get the sense, you know, with Helen Keller, that there was a moment where she got language. You know, do you know the story? I think we talked about it before in the class, where she kept on, the woman looking after her kept on putting her hand in water and pouring water on her hand and then signing the same sign. And there was a moment when she realised that means water. And I think for her that was a moment that she got world. She got the manifestness of being through that. She suddenly had language in the world all at once, in a single moment. And similarly with Wolf Girl, I think if she didn't have world, we might be able to, there may be a moment, you know, where you could see it clear. It would be a marvellous thing to witness, actually. But what we're struggling. The sense here also is the animal is struggling. And we're coming back to Jonas here. This when we just look at metabolism, at the continual struggle to maintain your own organisation, you know, because it's the disinhibiting ring, in a certain sense, is continuously struggling to maintain itself. Yes, because if it doesn't, if all of its drives are drives towards, to a certain extent, survival and the maintenance of the species. Yeah, they're all aimed at that. That they're ultimately all connected together towards this emergence of this form of organisation, which for the animal is the disinhibiting ring, out of the surrounding inanimate matter that just persists with no effort. Yes, and whereas the entire effort of the drives, the struggling, the drives are struggling always in their disinhibition to maintain the integrity of the animal. The tremendous energy is involved, and that's what the disinhibiting ring is, protecting the animal. This is protecting the integrity of the organisation of the animal. That's what it is. The animal is the organisation of its capabilities in the disinhibiting ring, in order for it to just to maintain its being. But its being is the being of this disinhibiting ring. Do you see it, sister? It's got that sense of the continuous struggle in it, which, in a way, I think they do have moments where they're just sitting on the branch, you know, the bird sitting on the branch, having a little song, where it's. Everything's good now. I hope so. I think there's a I think there's a background where just being alive is enjoyable in itself. I think the animals do have an experience of that, and we do too. I think we share the well-being of life I was talking about before. We can know it, but I think the animals have it as well. Otherwise, it'd be too terrible, wouldn't it? Just to be this continuous struggle for survival, I think.
Continuously looking for tweaks.
Yeah. So captivation is the fundamental essence of the organism. But he's, do you see what he's saying? What he's saying is, but we are not so captivated. We in some sense, as the pinnacle of evolution, which is that a Darwinist would not let me say that, you know, as for the mathematical mechanistic, we're the accident of evolution, but from the being point of view, we're the pinnacle of evolution, because in some sense, we have gone beyond that captivation.
Every one of us?
No, not necessarily, I guess. I mean, I you know, most, the majority of us. Again, you're reminding me of Barry, who was talking about the veil of opaqueness. In that myth, he said actually to begin with, only a few people became conscious in the way that we are, and they tyrannized the unconscious fellow humans. And that's the origin of slavery. It went, the whole of the human race became conscious in a certain way, but slavery lived on. You know, we're kind of afflicted by the mistakes of the past in a way. So, you know, you know how slavery seemed so, it's such an embedded habit in humanity. But I think it had some kind of foundation in the few woke up. And the vast majority didn't, and it was a process over a period of time. So I guess there are some people, individuals who still don't make it across the threshold now, with brain damage or whatever. But I don't know. It's a species achievement now. It's not just a. So final slide. It's so rare for me to get to the final slide. It is 2:15. And it's so rare for Heidegger to give a summary. But he did. He gives a summary. Captivation is a withholding of the possibility of the manifestness of beings. An animal can only behave, but never apprehend. The captivation of such behaviour is a being taken of instinctual activity in which the animal is open in relation to other things. So it's not... he agonised over this. If you read it carefully, he couldn't say the animal is really closed, because the animals are responsive, but only open insofar as the disinhibiting ring is disinhibited. So it's a special form of openness. Captivation is at the same time an absorption in the totality of interacting instinctual drives. So the animal's being is taken by the drive. And we know that, right? I think we all know that, when you can be taken by a drive, particularly sexual drives can take you like that, and it can be not altogether unpleasant, depending what kind of... That's not going there either. The animal has an intrinsic encircling ring within which it can be affected by whatever it is that disinhibits its capability for and occasions the redirecting of its instinctual drives. The struggling with the encircling ring is an essential character of life, commonly referred to as, and this is giving it in ordinary language now, self-preservation and maintenance of the species. Captivation is the condition of the possibility of behaviour in the sense that Heidegger means it. We don't behave, we comport ourselves towards beings. He calls our kind of behaviour doing and acting, because it's informed by our understanding of being. Full stop. End of lecture.